Seems to be I'm the pinch hitter around here. So she was going to talk about abandoning grief tonight. And, you know, if you are disappointed and want to leave, I'll try not to be too hurt as you walk out, but feel free to. What I'm going to talk about tonight is, well, the title of the talk is Pleasant, Unpleasant, Neither, Off and Running. And grief certainly probably fits in the deeply unpleasant category. So certainly what I had to say this evening has, I think, a lot of relevance to that particular issue. I'll just say a little bit about Narayan's talk, because she was going to give his talk several months ago, and I was very interested in what she was going to have to say about it. And then she gave a talk on something else, so I met with her about a week ago, and I said, so you're really going to talk about abandoning grief tonight? And she said, yes. And if you're wondering why she's not here, it's because she broke her wrist on Monday, I guess, and she needs to get surgery, which is going to be next Monday. So I'm hoping that she will be capable and willing to talk next week, which is what I was going to talk, because otherwise you might have to put up with me talking again. And I just want to say a little bit about abandoning grief, and the reason the topic interests me so much is abandonment is like the PhD of letting go. And there are various layers of letting go. And maybe in discussion, if you want, we can talk about this, because it's not what my talk is supposed to be about this evening. But the abandonment is to see deeply through the sense of self who's grieving, the sense of someone who has this experience. This is really the, you know, the profound jewel of the Buddhist teaching, is to see through this illusion of some sense of identity. And the Buddha never really said there wasn't a self. He simply said, very rather profoundly said, don't identify with things that are impermanent, unreliable as self. And, you know, that includes categories like the body, you know, we don't really control that. Something called feelings, which is my topic tonight. Perception, knowing, consciousness, and mental formations, which include emotions, thoughts, da-da. Don't identify with those as you. Okay, that's the proof. And so, you know, it's a pointer. I mean, we can't just decide, well, this is not me and I don't feel this. But it's something to really explore yourself. Can, you know, is there something else? Okay. So the title, Pleasant, Unpleasant, Neither, Off and Running, refers to simply something that's really very simple and yet just is so powerful. It's just this quality of our experience that has a tone to it. It's not an emotion. It's just whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, doesn't have much charge to it. So, for example, maybe when we were sitting here this evening and the air conditioning went on and there's a little bit of, got cold a little bit, maybe that had an unpleasant sense to it. That's what feeling tone would refer to. It's actually the each sense experience at each particular moment, actually, has some sort of feeling that comes along with it. So it could refer to bodily sensations. Maybe you're sitting in meditation and your knee hurts or your back hurts. That's probably an unpleasant feeling, right? So it's not, again, emotion. If you see something you really like, a beautiful flower or something, you might think, oh, you might have a pleasant feeling. Or if you see something that's very threatening or unpleasant feeling, or if you smell something rotten, it's an unpleasant feeling. You smell something really great, you know, there's some, you're really hungry and it's just that your dream food is there, that's a pleasant feeling. So this is a really It's an experience we have every moment. So in the Buddha constructed these really brilliant models about how their whole sense of form and self gets formed. And one aspect of his models, and so they're all simultaneous. So if I break out and say this happens because of this, it's like all kinds of things are influencing each other all the time. So in this model, there's something called contact. And contact is just when a sense door, like the eye or the ear or the nose, touch, what am I missing? I don't know. Hearing, I guess. Any sense door contacts a sense object, and there's knowing of it. And this goes on all the time, moment to moment. So, you know, if I ring this bell really loud, then, you know, the sense contact, the ear will hear it, think it's too loud to be an unpleasant feeling. And then, you know, there's the five ordinary senses, and in Buddhism, the mind is just another sense. And its object is itself. It kind of, there's an analogy or metaphor that the mind is kind of like a spider, and it weaves a web. And, you know, it does it. It's, and then it sort of waits for some juicy insect to come along. That's the contact, and the mind responds to that. So what I'm talking about tonight isn't emotions, but emotions have a feeling, you know, have a quality of being pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And sometimes that can be really helpful. For me, for a long time, I would just think, oh, you know, I have a really difficult emotion, and then like, oh, this is unpleasant. And it kind of tones it down a little bit. It simplifies it. This is an unpleasant feeling, and I don't want it. So we all have these experiences. We all have pleasant, unpleasant, and experiences, not much is happening. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just part of being human. The difficulty is that how we respond to them, how we react to them. So like we have a difficult emotion and like, I don't want this. And then now I'm kind of jumping ahead and talking already. But then we layer a whole layer of suffering on top of that. So it's not that we shouldn't respond to, let me just give some definitions, because I'm going to use different language because I get exposed. It gets used in different ways, and you should probably have some idea. So what I've been talking about, pleasant, unpleasant, not much charge, when the original, the Pali word, the language which the Buddha's teaching was written down is Vedana. And so when the original translations were done, they translated as feeling. But then that gets really kind of messy because feeling has a lot of definitions in the English language. If it could refer to an emotion or I feel that this is wrong, or, you know, just, it has about 14 definitions of feeling. So then people started adding this word tone to it to kind of take, you know, sort of make, well, what's that mean, feeling tone? And now psychologists use the word hedonic tone. So hedonic is pleasant, unpleasant, da da da. But it's just really pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So if I use the word feeling or Vedana, that's probably the only two I'll use, maybe feeling tone. I'm referring to pleasant, unpleasant, not much charge. So it's not that we shouldn't respond to feeling. It's just that we want to respond in a way that's wise. So certainly we have needs that have to be taken care of. You know, you feel hungry, I mean, you know, then you probably should eat. Or, you know, you need to get some rest. So the feeling is actually a very important aspect of our life. The problem occurs the problem occurs in a number of different ways. One is we only want, does anybody want unpleasant feelings in here? I mean, you don't have to reveal it in case you have a perverse psychology or something like that. But, you know, we want pleasant stuff. And we don't want the unpleasant stuff. And does anybody always have pleasant stuff in here? No, because they don't last. And there's all this effort running around trying to arrange things so that we have pleasant experiences and don't have unpleasant experiences, which seems like a very reasonable way to behave, except it doesn't work. And so the question then is, well, is there something else? Or is it, or even if there's nothing else, is there some way to respond in a more skillful way to it? So that's kind of what I want to talk about tonight a little bit. So if we think about this, I'm going to use the word vedana, I guess. When we have pleasant vedana, we want to keep it, right? And then there's kind of a disappointment when it's gone. I mean, it seems like it's a great thing to have, but actually the mind gets all excited about it. It exaggerates how good it is. And then, you know, it feels really great, but then, you know, and if it just stayed like that, well, maybe, but it doesn't. And then it gets disappointed, and it's got to run around and find something else to make it pleasant. That's how, I've been teaching another group every Wednesday night, and, you know, some of them really take it on, a lot of them don't, but I'll keep going at them every week, you know. See how you get pushed and pulled around by vedana. Just watch yourself during the day. It's amazing. Every time you move, probably. You want a range, not just sense experience, but we want pleasant emotions. Okay. So we want pleasant. We want to get rid of unpleasant. And the neutral, you know, kind of boring. Let's stir up something pleasant, right? That's sort of what happens. And since, I don't know, if you think we have a third of these sort of evenly distributed, I don't know. Ajahn Suchito thinks that there's a lot more unpleasant than pleasant, so I don't know. But, you know, if it's a third, kind of doesn't have much charge to it, we're like not with our life about a third of the time. We sort of blank out or run around and try and get something. And it isn't just that this desire for pleasant experiences is, you know, a personal problem. It's a societal problem. People want to feel powerful because it feels good. People think if they get more stuff, they'll be okay. People become addicted to sex or drugs or something, all for the you know, this underlying drive to feel pleasant stuff and not feel the unpleasant stuff. So, given that, how do we work with it? If we want to be free from it, we need some way to do it. And I kind of debated about whether to read this discourse, but there's some reasons that I think it's kind of worthwhile. This is a very famous discourse. I've forgotten the name of it. Sala Sutta or something. Sutta means discourse. And it refers to, you know, the first and second hour, or sometimes people use Dart as a translation. And I'll just read a couple of paragraphs from it. So this is a Buddha talking. He says, monks, the question is, what's the difference between a skilled, a well-instructed disciple and one who's not well-instructed? And the Buddha's answering the question. And his answer is, monks, an unrestricted, run-of-the-mill person feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, feelings of neither pleasure nor pain. Why they use that instead of neutral, I'm not sure, but that's the language you get used. A well-instructed disciple of the noble ones also feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, feelings of neither pleasure nor pain. So they both feel these different qualities. So what difference, what distinction, what distinguishing factor is there between the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones and the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person? And it is, I'll just read this without comment, at least till later. The Blessed One said, when touched with a feeling of pain, an uninstructed run-of-the-mill person becomes distraught, grieves, grieves and laments, beats his breast and becomes distraught. So he feels two pains, physical and mental, just as if they were about to just as if they were to shoot a man with an arrow, and right afterwards were to shoot him with another one, so that he would feel the pains of two arrows. In the same way, when touched with a feeling of pain, the uninstructed run-of-the-mill person sorrows, grieves, and laments, beats his breast, becomes distraught, so he feels two pains, physical and mental. So I don't know if he was trying to be funny in terms of the extent of this sorrow, grieves, laments, beats his breast. I mean, maybe you don't do all that, but you know, there is some another mental layer on top of the unpleasant experience. And often that mental layer we put on top of it is much more than the unpleasant experience. So the first arrow is the unpleasant experience. It's inevitable. It's all human beings have it. The second's optional. Are you going to add to it? You know, you sit here and the air conditioning goes on and it's cold. You know, it's just cold. But then you're like, why is this air conditioning? It gets really cold and then it sort of quiets down, and you know, or anything. So so one aspect of this, so we want to separate, the mind is really, you may just tell a little story, of it, give example how we layer on top of suffering. A good friend of mine was in hospital a few weeks ago, and she's been in and out of hospitals for months with a lot of problems. But at this particular time, she had C. diff, which is a horrible bacterial, very unpleasant thing, right? And she sent me an email, and I was on vacation, and she told me she'd like to have visitors, but I couldn't really come because, you know, I was away. And then the next day, it sort of sounded like she wanted someone to call her. Wasn't clear, because the first day she clearly didn't want calls because she had so much activity with doctors and stuff, she didn't think she had the energy for it. So I tried to call the hospital, and I got some answering thing, and the thing said that the nurse wouldn't be until 3 or 4 days later. So I tried her cell phone, and it said, this caller is not taking calls right now. And I thought, okay, you know, I can't talk with her. So I sent her an email and said, you know, I tried to call you, but this is what happened. So then she got out of the hospital, and she called me, and she said, you know, I just felt like nobody cared about me because nobody was calling me. And then I realized I didn't have any time on my cell phone. And she said, I spent the worst hour of my life trying to get time on her cell phone. Now, here's a person who's got C. diff, who's been in and out of hospitals, and this is the worst hour of my life. That's what the mind does. And I said, really? So this is part of new teaching I've been offering people. When the mind starts telling these stories, just go, really? Or, you know, actually some of my EU group has been translating it as, seriously? Or another approach is kind of treat the mind as if it has dementia. You know, as if is almost an understatement. Because it does. It really is like it has dementia sometimes. I mean, the stories it tells, you know, someone you really care about is wonderful, and then, you know, they do something to you, and they have no good qualities at all, right? So, you know, someone with dementia, you don't tell them to get your act together, right? You kind of, it's 1942, you know, why don't you sit down on the bench with me, and, you know, and you don't confront them and get them all upset. You just kind of treat them kindly and allow that stuff to be there, okay? So so I think a useful framework that gets taught a lot is this acronym RAIN, which just is to recognize there's some vedana occurring right here, right now. And that might seem rather simple, but often what happens is we're all lost up in the reaction to it, and we don't know, oh, it's unpleasant. And, you know, if it's something really difficult, I mean, after you see that, then you really have to ask yourself the question, do you have the capability to be with that right now? You know, some people have trauma or incredibly overwhelming emotions, and it's just really not wise to go into it, and you might want to step back from it. Or you can even start investigating it, it's just too much. But if you decide that, okay, and also you don't want to practice aversion. You know, want to just practice, oh, I can be with and grit your teeth and just, I really don't like this, but I'm going to tough it out. We really want to find a skillful way into it. So we want to, so after recognition, the A in this RAIN acronym is sometimes translated as acceptance, sometime allowing. And a lot of people don't like the word acceptance because it sounds like resignation. But acceptance really means to receive. So to receive the experience. Okay? And why should you do that? Well, for one reason, it's there. And another is you won't learn anything if you just keep trying to get away from it. And that's what we want to do. We want to learn a way to be with all experiences. And I'm not just saying that unpleasant experiences are the only problem. I'm saying pleasant experiences, as I described earlier, what the mind does with them is it gets excited, it kind of jumps up and down. Then it gets disappointed because it's not there anymore and it's got to run around and get something. So that's an issue as well. And but maybe later you can worry about having too much pleasure. But one thing is that a lot of difficult emotions are locked in our body. And so we really need to find a way to be with those emotions so they can be released. So it's another reason to be with it rather than just trying to get rid of it. So then the question gets to be, well, how? I mean, that's a real skill set. And I guess if I were to give maybe two or three words on that, it would be to soften and widen. Now, what does that mean? Well, widen would be to, one thing that happens is when there's difficult experiences, the mind contracts around it. It's like that's all there is. I remember several years ago, I was giving a talk and a guy, his nose was itching, and his whole world was that itchy nose. It really was, you know. And so to widen, part of that is to widen the spaciousness of the mind so it's not just focusing on this little problem we've got, or big problem from the mind's perspective. It's a huge problem. It's the worst problem you've ever had in your life, problem. So Joseph Goldstein has a nice little phrase, and the sky is blue, which I just love. It's just a really skillful way into broadening the mind. And then also the widening includes the body. When you have an unpleasant experience, well, see if you can find parts of the body that feel okay. You know, is the unpleasant experience in your toes or your knees or your buttocks? So if you start kind of widening the experience to include those, not just where the unpleasant stuff is, it just makes more room to hold it, just to allow it to be there. Or you can like be aware of the space around you or listen to sounds. So the strategy is you want to be with the experience but not lost in it. And, you know, I think it's very interesting that 2,600 years ago, this guy figured this out, and now there's this guy, Peter Levine, who wrote a book, written a couple of books, one's in an Unspoken Voice, which has to deal with trauma. And he has two techniques for dealing with difficult experiences, or two aspects of it. So one of them is what he calls titration. So if you put a chemical into something it's reactive to, and you put a lot of the chemical in, it'll blow up. But if you put a small amount of chemical in, you know, it just kind of gradually changes. So in some sense, by making room, making space, you're creating a titration. You're creating room for the experience to be there without it being overwhelmed. And then there's other aspect of his, and this is called somatic experiencing, if you're curious about this. The other aspect of that is, his teaching is that what he calls pendulation. And pendulation has to do with, you find parts that feel okay, and then you allow yourself to kind of move towards the unpleasant stuff, and then you go back and forth, so you can kind of be with it for a while, and you come back to the stuff that feels okay. So this is, and in Buddhism, I haven't really heard people talk about titration, but they are talking about finding this place that's okay. So in terms of some other things you can do is the breathing is so helpful. Really to ask yourself if you can come to the breathing process. And that's why some of this meditation is so good, because if you develop a skill to be with it, it's a refuge. It's a place of safety. And a lot of times people will be, watch the breath, but actually feel, okay? Not up in the head sort of watching, breath in, breath, but actually feeling the breath come in and out, and feel the rhythm of it. It's kind of like rocking a baby. It's very soothing. And sometimes if even very difficult experiences, if you can stay with it enough without getting overwhelmed, there actually can be joy arise out of it. Sometimes with very difficult experiences, you pay a lot of attention to it. There's people who have sat with really great pain and are so concentrated on working with it that they go into these deep states of concentration. And this is just a training. It takes time. And I think it's a certain element of faith, not faith in a blind sort of way, but faith in the sense that, this kind of makes sense. And just start exploring it, first with things that are somewhat manageable, and develop a skill for that. Okay. So if we can be with it, if we get enough space to be able to be with this experience, then the next step is investigation. And these all are, they're not sequential. They kind of, they work together. So one aspect of investigation is what I've talked about earlier about the two arrows. See if you can separate the mental experience from the physical experience. And you can just check your attitude, like, all right, I'll be with this, but it better go away soon. Or, maybe like, this shouldn't be here, or that sort of thing. We really, kind of want to just see if we can just really get curious and investigate, what's this like? Can I be with this? And just let it do what it needs to do. And that should take the jest out. Let it do what it needs to do, which it needs to express itself. The N refers to not identifying. Rather than this is mine, this is my feeling and pain, this is pain, period. It doesn't belong to anyone. Feeling feels, nature playing itself out. No one owns it, which is kind of this Vosaga abandoning grief type sort of thing. Because once we claim it as ours, the mind contracts around it. You're sunk. You're up in the story, I'll get rid of this, I can't believe it, da, 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 da. And, it's not like saying, there's no me or anything, but just look at what's going on. If it were you, why don't you just tell it to go away? It's not. It's, we really look at ourselves as this mind-body process that's playing out. And there's skillful ways to work with it. So these difficult emotions, these difficult experiences, they're just the very fiber of nature. It happens to everybody. And I remember when I was early in practice and I was having a difficult time with something, and Narayan said, well, just imagine at this very point, there's someone else having exactly the same experience. And I said, I don't find that helpful. And she's an honest yogi, you know. But it is. It's kind of realizing you're not so isolated with this. I've grown up a little bit. But it really is to realize that this is the nature of human experience. And this is why developing qualities like kindness and compassion are so helpful. That we all have this in common. So I mentioned that even pleasure is problematic and how with the neutral stuff we tend to get bored. And one thing that's really interesting about not just the neutral, but it's particularly an area of particularly way we can really practice is if you really pay attention, the neutral can become very pleasant. We're kind of lost in this sort of vague, kind of non-alive way of living. And there was a teacher, well, not in the Buddhist tradition, who had this, what she called unprovoked happiness, which I think maybe we call joy in this world, in Buddhist tradition. And by the way, I want to mention it. You know, I've been having these conversations with Madeline and Narayan about joy is really an essence of this practice. It really is. I mean, because it allows us to have compassion, to deal with difficulty. We kind of need to balance it. So if you start going through discourses, there's all kinds of stuff about joy all over the place. You know, the Buddha's part of the Buddha before his awakening. He after he'd done all of this asceticism stuff and he, you know, kind of had some milk, and then he remembered that when he was a young boy, he was sitting under this rose apple tree. And there was a festival going on. His father was plowing. They were plowing the fields and stuff. And he felt very safe. And he dropped into this deep state of absorption. And then he thought, why am I afraid of this? It doesn't cause any harm. So it's an essential part of practice. Okay. So when I talk about paying attention to joy, this particular woman gave this example of looking at a pile of laundry. And yeah, oh, it's a pile of laundry. But if you really look at it, there's all kinds of fabrics, textures, colors. When you really pay attention, you really can get some joy out of that. I started like doing this with clutter on the table. It's a particular kind of clutter, rather than all this, who put all this stuff up here, you know? And I have this pond I walk around, and I call it the... And there's a bridge, and I call it the bridge of unprovoked happiness. You know, you just go around, and there's this stream going underneath it, and the light's glistening on it. There's birds are singing. You know, and it just really open up to this very moment. This very ordinary things happen. There really is a joy that arises. But it's more than that. It's like, and I used to really dislike words like sacred, reverence. But actually, if you kind of take the attitude, like, this is it, this moment, isn't it a precious gift we have it? Well, maybe it doesn't feel that way when the Vedana is really unpleasant, but it's something to kind of, at least we're here. So kind of to form a perception of that. Like, to form a perception of recognizing, looking at things. And a lot of this practice is about perception, which if Narayan doesn't come next week is probably what I'll talk about. What's interesting, though, is the nature of attention itself is pleasant. Really paying very precise attention to smoke, because it's about connection. It's about being really here. When we're lonely, is because we're not connected. You know, I don't know. I mean, I go off on these retreats for 3 months. I don't have anything to read, da-da. But there's not a feeling of loneliness. because you're just really so connected with this very moment. And I, you know, be careful about this, because this is something to sort of aspire to. It takes work. Okay, and don't sort of say, "Oh well, I can't do that," or "I'm not there," and start laying a whole set of judgments on it. But just as something to sort of inspire the practice, something that's really amazing. So the interesting thing about attentiveness is it doesn't have an agenda. It doesn't want to get rid of the unpleasant. It doesn't want to have to have pleasant. It doesn't. It's not indifferent to the neutral. It's just there. It's just aware of this is what's happening this moment. It's really kind of stepping out of this whole process of reactivity to our experience. Now we're kind of getting into the really sort of deep part of this practice is about. It's about what happens is when some sort of experience touches the mind heart, and that's the word that the Buddha uses. He uses heart, this felt sense. You know, Vedana is a felt sense. When it touches that, the mind, it kind of activates the mind. It reacts to it. It wants to do something about it. So the training is, you know, a part of practice is to work with this compulsive reflex that it just seems to be a natural way of being. To get rid of pain and get pleasure and just keep being with it, just seeing how, pleasant comes, pleasant goes, unpleasant comes, unpleasant goes. You know, if you look at the discourse on mindfulness, the so-called Satipatthana Sutta, the first three parts of it are, you just watch. You're not trying to do anything at all. So in some sense, it's this very teaching of not reacting, not having to fix, not having to do. And you start seeing that this stuff just comes and goes. And so we talk about impermanence, but it's more than an idea. It's something when you really pay attention. You just start seeing how these emotions, these sensations come and go all the time. Last week I was, all kinds of things happened. You know, my son had all bunch of people over one night, and they were kind of going in and out all night long and waking me up, and I couldn't believe 10, 20 times. And, and the mind's like, then I was trying to get a place to go on retreat, and it was advertised at $1,000 a month, and this is great. I write to the person, and they say, we're glad to rent it to you for $2,000. And I sort of go, so there's this is a great place. I really go there, and then, oops. And then, I went back, and I said, I'm a little confused here. I didn't get in a rage, are you kidding me? But, I said, it says on your website it's $1,000 a month, And so, finally, it's $1,000 a month. I think I have a place, I send a deposit in anyway. But you just watch how, this is going on all the time. And you start really paying attention to it. It loses its juice. Or, maybe not juice is entirely gone, but it's less charged to it. So the more we work with it, the less the mind's inclined to be reactive, the less it's kind of trying to catch that little juicy bug on its web that it's created. And it doesn't really need to have pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There's something where the mind just doesn't construct, doesn't fabricate all this stuff. The word that gets used most often is stillness. It's not particularly pleasant or unpleasant. It just is. And it's actually an experience that's undescribable in a sense. Not undescribable because it's so exhilarating, but it's undescribable because this I am-ness, this abandonment, isn't there. So there's no one to describe it. There's no one spinning the web. It's kind of a direction to move into that maybe we can have moments like this. And the more we recognize them, the more we can kind of say, oh, they're there all the time. We just don't see it. Let's just try a little experiment. Okay? Just turn your awareness to what you conceive of as you. Your body, for example. So, what is the body? And what do you feel? Well, there might be some pressure where the buttocks is contacting the couch, the cushion or the chair. There might be some sense of temperature. There might be the rhythm of the breathing. Or maybe you could pay attention, turn your attention to what the emotional state is right now. Or what thoughts are occurring right now. So there's this attention, this quality of awareness that's aware of you. Okay. Now, be aware of the awareness. So I don't know whether you can do that or not, but there's like this felt sense. There's something that's aware of the awareness of you. It's both inside and outside. And it's there all the time when we're not spinning our web of stories. I want this, need this, da-da. The mind sees into itself. It knows itself. It knows that it's constructing all this stuff. That's kind of, in some sense, the end game of this. And it's not like we get there and then we're totally free of all our problems, but it's something that provides some space that allows us to hold all these challenging experiences of being a human being. I was listening to a talk by Ajahn Sucitto today on Nibbana, and he was talking about, well, just because you realize this doesn't mean that you don't have any problems anymore. And he brought up Mahabua, who was a very, supposedly an arahant, Thai forest monk, who was very tough and didn't hesitate pointing out your deficiencies. And he's very well respected because they really thought he had achieved, this freedom. And then finally one day someone went to him and said, why are you so mean and ornery all the time? So here's this guy that's kind of got this, but, underlying his stuff is still this character, these programs that are running. And he just laughed. Like he's not identifying, this is what I am. And, I don't think that doesn't mean he should have done some more work, but... That's just my opinion. It's like we start just being aware of this awareness, just to look into the nature of the mind. It gives us some ability to just allow this stuff to happen, to develop some sort of dispassion, which is another level of the letting go. It's not down the Vosaga PhD stuff, but it's sort of helping. And so... if you kind of think about the whole journey, this practice, which to me was a really big insight, so I hope maybe for one other person it's helpful, is that much of this practice is creating bright vedana, uplifting vedana, pleasant vedana. And it's to do it through working with skillful use of the mind. Because at least the you have a little bit more control over mental experiences you do over physical experiences. And so if you look at what the path of practice is, there's what's called, there's this word karma or kama. It just means actions of body, speech, and mind. Okay, it's not any big, everything that ever happened to you is because, your 12th life ago or something like that. Except in the Tibetan tradition, they seem to translate a different way. But, there's discourses the Buddha makes it very clear. It's more like your psychological cause and effect. And so a lot of practice is creating bright, you know, doing action that creates bright results, cause and effect. And what creates bright karma? Well, being kind to yourself, kind to other people, being compassionate, developing joy, developing quality of equanimity. Of the meditation process itself, for some of you may not believe this, but it's actually supposed to be pleasant. And actually, you know, we often meditate to get pleasant, but really you want to bring these qualities to the meditation. Okay, so, you know, the practice for a long, long time, maybe forever, is creating bright karma. But the end game is not creating any karma at all. Not the mind isn't reactive. It isn't spinning a web. And we can visit this place. We can maybe some of you visit a little bit tonight, just to be aware of yourself and then aware of the awareness that's always there. The mind sees into itself, and it sees it's like creating this whole thing. You know, it's like Shakespeare, full sound and fury signifying nothing, you know? I mean, that's at the level of it at some point. Okay. So I'm going to end there a little longer than I meant to be, but hopefully Narayan will be here next week. If she's not, we'll talk about perception, I guess, okay? And I want to open up to questions. I don't particularly think I'm extremely skilled on dealing with grief, although I've kind of visited this subject from time to time. But, you know, I think much of what I said tonight really applies to that. So, you know, anything, suffering, stress, dissatisfaction, joy, love, kindness, all open for discussion. Yeah.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.